The scripture reading before this morning's lesson can be found in Matthew chapter 16, verses 24 through 27. Matthew 16, 24 through 27. Then Jesus told his disciples, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life would lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what will a man profit if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? Or what shall a man give in return for his soul? For the Son of Man is going to come with his angels in the glory of his Father, and then he will repay each person according to what he has done."
That one on? So am I stuck here this morning then? Ah! All right. Well, can you hear me okay? Okay. Oh, well. That's technology for you. And I was on such a roll, too. Just come forward as we stand and sing. To our visitors here this morning, I want to welcome you. If you have any questions at all about the way that we do things here, except for the technology that we use that fails at times, please let any one of us know. All we want is to spread the gospel. We just want other people to know the way that we have come to know what it means to be saved by the blood of Jesus Christ, by his grace, his mercy, and his incredible love. So, for sentimentality's sake, I was recently going through some of my more interesting possessions in my office. Do you ever have days like that where you just kind of, you know, you're thumbing through your old books or you're kind of looking through some of your curiosities? I know that not everybody's the same as me. Some people don't really care about possessions. Other people have very specific kinds of collections they've put together. I have curiosities. I don't like to collect one. I don't like to collect like one kind of thing. I like to collect a bunch of odd stuff from all kinds of different places, especially stuff that has some value to my family or our family's history. One of my most cherished treasures in my office is a collection of several hundred of my Grandpa Bill's handwritten sermon notes. Grandpa Bill preached for a long time. He started in Texas, and he was in Ohio, and then he was in Washington and Oregon. And of course, that's how my mom's side of the family ended up in Oregon. And he preached up in the Portland area for a number of years. And one of the things that I got was some of his books, but one of the things I got was those handwritten sermon notes. That's actually what's the background there on the sermon slides this morning. And I have his notes right here. Now, don't worry. I'm not just going to use his notes. This is not going to be any kind of verbatim lesson from my grandpa's material. In fact, it's been 5 or 6 years since I've even drawn from those notes to come up with a sermon idea. It's hard as a preacher to adapt someone else's material to your own work. And so I very rarely will take from my grandpa's sermon notes and build any sermon out of it. But as I was thumbing through these sermon notes, again, just for kind of sentimentality's sake, I came across a title that just really stood out. It was called Bargain Religion. And so I started reading through his notes, and it was a rather interesting look into the religious environment of his time period. Grandpa probably wrote this sermon either in the late 1970s or the early 1980s. Let me read you a couple of things. It's, like I said, it's a peek into a time period that is very different from our own. He noted in his beautiful cursive handwriting that many people today are turning to religion for the first time. Church rolls are swelling, buildings are crowded, new buildings are being constructed. America is experiencing a new religious uprising, and church membership is higher, or at least as high, as it's ever been. And he says, why is that? Now, statistics do bear this out that in the 1970s and 1980s, church membership, at least Christianity broadly defined, so understand what I'm saying by that, this would be kind of inclusive of all who identify as Christian regardless of denomination, religion in general was on the upswing in the 1970s and 80s, this kind of post-1960s resurgence of broadly defined Christianity in America. And that kind of carried even through into the 1990s. And up until 1999, 70% of Americans still said that they were members of a church or a synagogue. Through 1999, 70% of Americans still claim to be members of a church or synagogue. Now, my grandpa notes in his material that part of this was driven by fear in the 70s and 80s. Part of it was about the ongoing conflict between East and West, between the United States and the Soviet Union, between communism and Western forms of government and economics. Part of it was trying to return to some sense of normalcy because the prestige of the United States after the Vietnam War really took a major hit. And this idea that the United States was this, like, this untouchable, all-powerful beacon of goodness and hope and light in the world, after Vietnam, that image really took a major hit in people's perception. And so, in a sense, people were turning to religion, broadly speaking, to regain that sense of normalcy and safety that they felt before the 1960s. Now, we see in the Bible that periods of upheaval often drive people back toward God. Whether you're talking about the 70s or 80s in our own history, or you're looking at the Judges. Our kids are going through the book of Judges right now in their Bible classes, and you can see very clearly this cycle in the book of Judges. They over and over and over again experience a time of peace, but that peace leads to transgression of some kind, idolatry, moral ambivalence and indifference, which leads to upheaval and then being conquered by some nation. And in the midst of the upheaval, there's a spiritual renewal. People return to God. God sends a judge and rescues them. And then they have 40 years of peace again. But in the midst of those 40 years of peace, morality starts to sag again, idolatry creeps back in, and because of that, God will send another conqueror. They get conquered, there's upheaval, there's renewal, there's rescue, there's peace. Wash, rinse, repeat. And that's what the book of Judges is really about. And so upheaval, in a way, does tend to drive people back toward God, if only in a superficial way. Now, I say superficial, and perhaps the greatest example of this is the superficial return to God during the time of King Josiah. Well, hold on, Ryan. Whenever I read Josiah's story, that just seems like the gleaming example of people giving their hearts back to God. And I'll acknowledge that as long as Josiah was around, the people probably did give their hearts over to God. But I think a lot of that renewal during the time of Josiah was a superficial renewal. When you read about Josiah's story, and this is just a few decades before Babylonian captivity, when you read about Josiah's story, servants in the temple discover, or rediscover, I suppose, a copy of the law of God. Recognizing its importance, they bring it to King Josiah and say, look what we found collecting dust in a back room in the temple. Josiah instantly knows what it is and he tears his clothes. He knows that the people of Judah have not been following God's law as they should have been. And so under Josiah's leadership, Judah returns to God. They reinstitute things like the Passover, and the text says that they celebrated a Passover that was more passionate than any that had happened in generations. He starts tearing high places down, destroying temples. The reading of the law is happening in public again, and it sure seems like Judah has returned to God. But what's interesting is, when you turn to books like Zephaniah or Jeremiah, these are prophets who, according to their own testimony, prophesied during the days of Josiah. When I read Jeremiah, I'm not reading a book that is just happy-go-lucky, everything's going really well, and everybody's returned to God and things are fine in Judah right now. I read the book of Jeremiah, and it is foreboding and dark and pessimistic, which at least is an indication to me on some level that a lot of what Josiah did during his lifetime was probably, for a lot of people, fairly superficial. Now, that's not a knock on Josiah. Josiah is one of the most awesome characters in all the Bible. He turned his heart fully over to God and deserves all the credit that we give to him for being an amazing leader in his time period. But don't you find it interesting that even with all of Josiah's great things that he did, by the time of the very next king, everything had just returned to normal. Back to idolatry, back to immorality, back to turning away from God, right at the very next king. A heart that is far from God, in the midst of a body that's doing what it's told, really isn't close to God at all. Jesus quotes in Matthew chapter 15, verses 7 through 20, speaking of the Pharisees there, and how they love to keep certain commandments. They love to keep their own commandments in particular, to the neglect of God's commandments. And Jesus himself quotes from Isaiah chapter 29, verses 13 and 14. Even though this people draws near to me with their lips, their heart is far from me. They do what they're told. They say the right things. But on the inside, they don't really care. It's all superficial. And so when Grandpa Bill, his name was Bill Fain, by the way, when Grandpa talks about bargain religion in his time period, he makes an interesting quote about this, that even though you can look at all the resurgence of this kind of broad Christianity in the 1970s and 80s, you look at the campaigns of Billy Graham and Oral Roberts and the televangelists and all that sort of thing. Grandpa made an observation about that. He said, in some respects, this is not a healthy sign, because instead of turning to Christ, men are turning to a weakened, watered-down counterfeit religion that in reality stands for nothing, teaches nothing, demands nothing, costs nothing, and is worth nothing. In other words, bargain religion. Bargain religion. And so whether you're talking about the time of the judges, or you're talking about the time of Josiah, or you're talking about the Pharisees in the time of Jesus, whatever time period you're talking about, if you are trying to look for faith on the cheap, if you're trying to look for bargain bin religion, be careful, because you're going to get bargain bin results out of it. So what's different today then, right? So, you know, we go from reading stuff like this in the 1970s. And like I said, reading Grandpa's handwritten notes from the late 70s makes you go, here he is talking about church buildings being full and church membership swelling and Americans returning in droves to religion. And then you look at the year 2021 and you go, well, you know, we all have problems. You know, different problems. You look at a graph like this and you go, okay, well, by today, what is happening to people who identify as members of a church or a synagogue? And you see that today, it's now well below 50%. In fact, today it's about 47%, if it hasn't even slipped a little bit further since the pandemic occurred. And so now, for the first time ever, you're looking at less than half of Americans who identify as members of a religious body of some kind, a church or a synagogue or a mosque. And so what's different about today? Why are people leaving churches where in the 1970s people were being driven to churches and synagogues and other religious institutions? Well, I have one explanation for it, and it's a partial explanation, but we'll fill this out as we go through the rest of the lesson. I think people are still selling bargain religion today. The problem is that folks just aren't buying it anymore. And maybe you can call that a problem. Maybe you can call that a good thing. I don't know. C.S. Lewis made an observation when somebody pointed out to him that church attendance in England was lagging during his lifetime. C.S. Lewis made an observation that really what's happening is it's just that we're not losing Christians. It's just that people who aren't really interested in commitment are the ones who are leaving. And so now it's just easier to tell the ones who are really interested in being committed to Jesus Christ. Well, the issue in the 70s and 80s was that Christianity was made convenient and it was popularized by televangelists, which resulted in like a cheap pop culture version of the gospel. The problem today is that churches are so desperate not to lose members that they've intentionally watered down major components of the faith that are deemed offensive, divisive, or antiquated. It was almost like back in the 1970s, we wanted to turn Christianity into McDonald's. We wanted to make it easy and prepackaged and easy to digest and familiar and comforting, but not really full of anything. Really not a ton of substance to it. Not a lot of nutritional value. And hey, when you offer McDonald's religion, people will come in droves for McDonald's religion. But the issue today is that now, because we're scared of people leaving churches, because we're scared of people leaving in droves, we're trying to offer bargain, bargain, bargain. Come to my church where you don't have to believe anything. Come to my church where we're not going to make you feel uncomfortable. Come to my church where if you didn't like what they taught down the street, well, you don't have to worry about it here because we're not going to teach that. We're trying to offer bargain, bargain, bargain. And you know what? To people's credit today, to millennials' credit, to Generation Z's credit, I don't think what they want is a bargain anymore. And there's a reason why millennials and Gen Zers don't really eat at McDonald's much anymore. Right? They're not the ones who are keeping McDonald's in business anymore. And you can only offer cheap religion, bargain religion, so long before people start to realize what they've been eating all these years. You offer someone cheap food, it's going to taste cheap in the end. And so in their attempts at recapturing the popularity of religion in the 20th century, a lot of religions today have jettisoned everything that would just make them unpopular today, which is kind of ironic. When you look at a lot of the statistics of religion in America, it's actually the most liberal Protestant denominations that are losing membership at the fastest rate. Since 1965, the most liberal American Protestant denominations, Presbyterian Church in America, Episcopalians, Lutherans, that sort of thing, have lost between 50 and 65% of their membership since 1965. And I'm not just talking about as a representation within America's population. I mean gross numbers. 50 to 65% gross numbers have left the most liberal Protestant denominations in America. Now bear with me for a sec. I want to explain something about myself. I don't believe I'm a snobby person. In fact, I like a good deal. I do like a bargain. I shop. All my clothes are clearance, right? If there's a rack in the back of the store and it's got a big red sign on it, that sign might as well just say Ryan, right? It's like a blinking light for me. So I like a good deal. I like when I buy a car, I like to feel like I'm getting a good deal on it. You know, I'll spend 3 hours haggling just to save $5 or something on whatever. But there is, and I fully own it. Like, I take responsibility for it, my friends. There is one area of life that I am an unabashed snob. And that's when it comes to generic food. If you're going to offer me a Coca-Cola, give me a Coca-Cola, okay? I don't want the Great Value brand. If you're going to offer me Dr. Pepper, don't hand me like Dr. Pop or something like that and make me think, well, it tastes just like Dr. No, it doesn't. Dr. Pop doesn't taste like Dr. Pepper. It doesn't. And Oreos don't taste like Cheerios. You can tell the difference. You can tell the difference between Oreos and Cheerios. And so I own it, okay? I own it. I am a snob in one area of my life. I don't do generic or off-brand food. I just don't. I just don't. I want the real thing. I want the actual brand. Now, I'm being silly here. You guys understand what I mean here. But let's take it from this silly step over here and take one more step in a more serious direction, okay? There are certain areas of life where you really shouldn't go cheap on things, where it's better just to spend a little bit more to get the right thing than to kind of spend less and it just doesn't quite work as well, right? When you're fixing a house, okay, or you're building a house, if you use the absolute cheapest building materials all the time in building a house, from top to bottom, from foundation to roof, if everything in your house is the absolute cheapest that you can buy, well, that's not a house that's going to be standing 50 years from now. It's just not. Now, that's the house that you can afford. That's the house you can afford. But don't expect a house with the absolute bare bones cheapest material to still be standing in 50 years. If you're fixing a car, right, you can fix a car with like some off-brand, maybe it kind of works part, or you can just spend the money and get the right part. If you are always being a tightwad when it comes to fixing your car or the kind of oil that you use, right, don't be surprised 1,000 miles later when that car breaks down again. There are just some areas of life where, you know, just don't be a cheapskate about it. And if that's true in some silly sense with off-brand sodas or whatever, and if that's true when it comes to big things like building a house or fixing a car, then how much more is it true with something that really matters, like your faith? You can't go cheap on faith. You can't sift through the bargain bin of religion and expect to have anything but bargain bin results in your faith. You can't have watered down religion, empty superficial worship, and meaningless doctrine and expect to walk away with a really substantial, strong, meaty faith. It's impossible. And the entire Bible attests to this fact. From cover to cover, the Bible attests to when you go the bargain route on religion, when you go the bargain route on knowing God, when you go the bargain route on morality or doctrine of righteousness and unrighteousness, of right and wrong, you'll always end up looking like the fool in the end. Adam and Eve in Genesis chapter 3. Adam and Eve had everything that they could have wanted, but they exchanged it all for a bite of food when they weren't even hungry. In Genesis chapter 19, Lot's wife, so that she could take one last look at a life that she was leaving behind, she lost the rest of her life. Everything that she could have been in the future was lost because she wanted to take one last look at the life that she was leaving behind. Esau in Genesis chapter 25 despised his birthright. It was all pointless to him because he saw a bowl of some red stuff and was hungry. Achan in Joshua chapter 7. Achan lost his life over a garment that he couldn't wear and over money that he couldn't spend. Like, at what point was Achan going to be able to wrap that mantle around himself and walk around, like strut around the camp of the Israelites? At what point in his life was he ever going to be able to wear that mantle without somebody recognizing it and going, oh, hey, wait a minute. Wasn't that supposed to be under the band? At what point was he going to start pulling out Jericho coinage, right? Jericho coinage, start spending Jericho money, and someone's not going to go, well, hold on a second. All of that Jericho money was supposed to be devoted to God. What are you doing with a pocket full of Jericho money? He lost his life for a garment he couldn't wear and for money he couldn't spend. Samson in Judges 16 for the caress of a woman who had trouble written all over her. He lost his strength. He lost his dignity. Ahab in 1 Kings chapter 21. His demise was foreshadowed when he saw somebody else's field and wanted it for his own. The fool in Matthew chapter 7 verses 26 and 27. Remember, Jesus says there, the wise man is the one who builds his house upon the rock, and when the storm comes, his house will be secure. But a fool builds his house upon sand. You know why? Because it's cheaper, it's faster, and it's easier. You want bargain religion? Build your house upon the sand. It's cheaper, it's faster, and it's easier. But because he went the bargain route, building his house, he got bargain results when the storm came and destroyed it. Judas in Matthew chapter 27 betrayed his friend, his teacher, and his master for a bag of money that he didn't even have the conscience to keep. Demas in 2 Timothy 4 verse 10, Paul laments of the fact that Demas loves this present world too much and he has abandoned us. And in Matthew chapter 16, which was our scripture reading at the beginning of the lesson, in Matthew chapter 16, verses 24 through 27. What does it profit a man if he were to gain the entire world, but to lose his soul? When you go cheap on knowing God, you will get cheap results. So let me give you three applications here to this lesson, then I'll go ahead and bring it to a close. The first application that I see on bargain religion is this, that you just can't do Christianity on the cheap. While it might temporarily help things like attendance figures or our standing in the broader culture, compromise with the world or watering down our faith is never what God wants. Rather, God wants total commitment. He wants absolute self-sacrifice. And he wants unapologetic rejection of the world. Go to this passage in 1 John chapter 2. And notice in 1 John chapter 2, the way that it's written in verses 15 and onward. 1 John chapter 2, verse 15. Do not love the world nor the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes and the boastful pride of life is not from God, but is from the world. And the world is passing away and also its lusts. But the one who does the will of God abides forever. Now there's a lot of different ways you can apply this. A lot of practical things that you can think about. Whether it's in our attendance at worship, our commitment to worship, our engagement in worship, our willingness to stick to a Bible reading plan, our prayer life, other spiritual disciplines like that, our willingness to practice charity and benevolence, to open up our homes with our brethren, to be vulnerable with our brethren when they've committed a sin and they wish to talk about uncomfortable things with us, or when we've committed a sin and we're willing to talk about them with other people. If you just want to keep your Christianity surface level, you're good with digging through the $5 DVD bin at Walmart, and that's kind of where you get your faith is, I'm fine digging through the $5. Like, I'm fine, like, what Friday night movie night? I'm going to watch an old Wayans Brothers movie or something that I found for $5 in the bargain bin at Walmart. If, wow, that really kind of was very specific, wasn't it? But if that's what you think your Christianity is going to be, you're not going to get much out of it. You're not going to be a very changed person from it. But a second application, and I know I've kind of touched on this a little bit, but bargain religion comes with bargain results. And I like the way that it's put in several examples from Revelation chapters 2 and 3. I think you get some of the bargain religion in Revelation 2 and 3. When Jesus is talking directly to the seven churches of Asia in Revelation 2 and 3, there were several of these churches that thought they would get away with things like lackluster enthusiasm or compromised doctrine or turning a blind eye to immorality in their churches. To the church at Ephesus, he says in chapter 2, verses 4 and 5, you've lost your first love. Like, if you think you can do Christianity and not have love, then you're not really doing Christianity, are you? He goes on in chapter 3 to the church at Sardis, and he says, I know your deeds, that you have a name that you're alive, but you're dead. You have a name that you're alive, surface level, you look good on the outside, but on the inside you're dead. Most pointedly, at the end of chapter 3, writing to the church at Laodicea, I know your deeds, you're neither hot nor cold. I would that you were hot or cold, but because you're lukewarm and neither hot nor cold, I'll spit you out of my mouth. And in verse 17, because you say, well, I'm rich and I've become wealthy, I've need of nothing. You have no idea that you are wretched and miserable and poor and blind and naked. You have no idea just what you're missing out on because you've deluded yourself into thinking that the cheap version is good enough for you. And finally, salvation is one of those strange things that costs nothing, but also costs everything at the same time. It costs nothing, but it costs everything at the same time. We acknowledge, as the scriptures do, that grace cannot be earned. From Ephesians chapter 2, verses 8 through 10, from Romans chapter 3, verses 24 through 26, grace is the gift of God. We can never earn it. It's described as Romans chapter 6, verse 23, as the free gift of God. But interestingly enough, in Romans 6, in that same context, in the same chapter where he says salvation is the free gift of God, he also spends a whole lot of the chapter talking about our slavery to God. That you go from being a slave to sin and the slave of the things of the world to being a servant of God, a wholehearted, fully devoted servant of God. You've given your entire life over to him. So again, salvation costs nothing, but it also costs everything. You have to give everything over to God. Anything short of complete surrender to Christ is unacceptable. Anything short of full investment into God is unacceptable. 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and verses 19 and 20. You have been bought with a price. You don't own yourself anymore. God owns you. Matthew chapter 10 and verses 37 through 39. Jesus points out in Matthew chapter 10. He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. He who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. He who does not take his cross and follow after me is not worthy of me. He who has found his life shall lose it. He who has lost his life for my sake shall find it. And so in the end, I'll make this final comment. I cannot afford the folly of bargain religion. Whether it's compromising on doctrine, whether it's going cheap on my investment in the local congregation, my time, my energy, my love, my emotion, whether it's keeping God at arm's length and not really welcoming him into my life, or thinking that I can always just keep things happy and superficial and surface level and I don't really have to go any more uncomfortable than that. I cannot afford the folly of bargain religion. And neither can you. If you're not a Christian here this morning, you really ought to be. Listen to the gospel message as it's presented so simply and so eloquently by Jesus himself, where he says in Mark 16, he who believes and is baptized shall be saved, but he who does not believe shall be condemned. So if you'd like to respond to that invitation with any spiritual need at all, please let it be known by coming forward as we stand and sing.